Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we are once again going to step back into the past, in this case 50 years into the past, and we are going to be examining some columns by the very famous columnist Drew Pearson that were written by Drew Pearson near the end of World War II, specifically on April 25th and April 26th of 1945. I'm speaking now on the evening or the afternoon of September 2nd of 1995. And some of the very last of the many 50th anniversary commemorations has been taking place. The 50-year commemorations began really in 19... Well, I shouldn't say they began, but they gained momentum in June of 1944 with the 50th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, D-Day. And they gained steam as the 50th anniversary of the end of the war in Europe, as well as the liberation of many of the concentration camps, took place. The 50th anniversary of the first dropping in wartime of the atomic bomb, namely the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and later Nagasaki, took place. The actual first use of an atomic bomb against human beings, however, took place in a test in July of 1944 in Suisun Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area, when in the Port Chicago explosion, the explosion of the E.A. Bryan, ostensibly an ammunition ship explosion was used to mask the first test, this of the Mark II weapon, never actually deployed in combat. The 50th anniversary is peaked with, or I should say, that perhaps not peaked, but reached what will hopefully be a conclusion with the 50th anniversary of the signing of the surrender on the deck of the battleship USS Missouri, that surrender by the Japanese officially ending the combat of World War II. As we have seen in numerous archive shows available from Archives on Audio, about which I'll have more to say later, we have seen that many of the combatants from World War II and many of the units continue to struggle not only in the Cold War, and we're going to examine the roots of the Cold War and how those roots are inextricably connected with very powerful industrial and financial forces themselves, inextricably linked with the powers of fascism, and in turn, inextricably linked with the American power structure. But many of the forces that were fighting in World War II on the fascist side later regrouped and began, quote, fighting alongside the Allies, unquote. They actually regrouped with the West during the Cold War. And in some cases, they actually perpetuated the combat, such as the various nationalist and fascist guerrilla groups in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, which had actually fought under the direction of the OKW, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, German military high command, and later jumped to U.S. intelligence, NATO, and other umbrellas, while essentially simply switching uniforms and perpetuating the combat. As we look back not only on the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender, but also related events, and in the Drew Pearson columns that I'm going to be reading, Drew Pearson was observing the formation of the world to come as the conference which was to result in the formation of the United Nations, or to kick off the United Nations, was gathering steam here in San Francisco. I would also note that the columns that I'm going to be reading were suppressed by Drew Pearson's distributor, the Bell Syndicate. They were later introduced into the read into the Congressional Record by Congressperson Helen Gehagan Douglas, one of the first of many worthwhile people to fall beneath the political battle axe of Richard Nixon, about whom we'll have more to say in just a minute. But again, as the 50th anniversary of the formal surrender of the Japanese in World War II is passing behind us, as we here in the Bay Area have concluded this past spring, the 50th anniversary of the formation of the United Nations, which took place right here in San Francisco, I think it is worth contemplating the historical and political forces which produced fascism and which produced World War II, because those forces are absolutely central to the contemporary operations of the world, the same types of financial and industrial powers with their corresponding political and national security elements have had much to do with shaping the world today, and had much to do with shaping the course of what came to be known as the Cold War, a struggle which eventually saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the financial and, in my opinion, political bankrupting of the United States, a country which is, in my opinion, in the last stages of descent into fascism, and which will not only collapse financially, but I suspect sometime in the 21st century will break apart geographically as well. This will seem like utter drivel to the uninitiated. However, stay tuned. To keep your eyes peeled, those of you who live into the 21st century, for the secession of Hawaii, perhaps even the secession of the American Pacific Northwest, perhaps even a real or de facto secession of the American South. I suspect this will follow a total economic collapse and a political crisis in which America will lurch completely into overt German-style fascism. I expect a balkanization of the United States at some point around the middle or second half of the 21st century, if not before. However, we are getting ahead of ourselves, and I think in order to once again commemorate the formal end of World War II, and in order to contemplate the forces which brought about that conflict, which later precipitated the Cold War, and in fact were in the process of helping to precipitate the Cold War, as we shall see, even as World War II was winding down, and in order to understand the nature of the political forces not only underlying World War II and the Cold War, but the political forces underlying fascism in the World War II and pre-World War II periods, and the forces underlying fascism today, because in order to understand some of the statements that I'm making, and I'm sure they will quite understandably sound preposterous to new or uninitiated listeners, when I talk about fascism coming to this country, it's because fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of our most powerful industrialists, financiers, political and national security figures were ardently, wholeheartedly pro-Nazi and pro-fascist. Their dollars and their efforts helped to not only financially underwrite but politically support and in some cases almost create the fascist powers of Europe during World War II. Those same forces saw to it that denazification and the elimination of fascism were essentially a formal political myth. It never really occurred, not at the institutional level, and those same forces found it only too easy to ally with the residual forces of fascism in order to begin waging the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Earlier in the summer of 1995, one of the foremost political researchers and journalists in this country's history, George Seldes, passed away at the ripe old age of 104. Seldes is viewed by many as the dean of American investigative reporting. I am among those who see him in that light, and I could not exaggerate the importance and the brilliance of George Seldes' work. George Seldes was a brilliant investigative reporter and anti-fascist. His work, sadly, has been eclipsed following the McCarthy period. However, the importance of his work, as I said, could not be exaggerated. A listener was going through one of George Seldes' many, many books, and Seldes was nothing if not prolific. This particular book is called The People Don't Know, subtitled The American Press and the Cold War, authored, of course, by George Seldes, last name Seldes, published by Geyer Associates in New York, that's G-A-E-R, and copyright 1949. In this particular book, again subtitled The American Press and the Cold War, in Appendix 4, there is a very important couple of columns that were written by the very famous syndicated columnist Drew Pearson. These, however, were suppressed at the suggestion of his editors and, quote, at the insistence of J.P. Morgan and Company and the Chase Bank, as we shall see. Later, they were introduced into the congressional record on May 1, 1945, by Helen Gehagen Douglas, later defeated for re-election by Richard Nixon, an individual whose entire political career was inextricably linked with the forces of fascism and organized crime. More about Richard Nixon, our, quote, elder statesman, unquote, later on in the program. In The People Don't Know, again, The American Press and the Cold War by George Seldes, again in Appendix 4, there is this title over the columns by Drew Pearson. Again, these were written in San Francisco on April 25th and April 26th of 1945, a little over 50 years ago. Again, I'm speaking on 9/2/95 for the benefit of those who hear this program on tape. This particular appendix was entitled by George Seldes, U.S., Nazis, and World War III by Drew Pearson. The note underneath that reads, several important columns written by Drew Pearson were suppressed by suggestion of his editors, the Bell Syndicate, and, quote, at the insistence of J.P. Morgan and Company and the Chase Bank, unquote, according to Congresswoman Helen Gehagen Douglas, who inserted the whole series in the congressional record May 1, 1945, from which the most important parts are given below. And the first column, again from San Francisco, April 25th, reads as follows, as reprinted by George Seldes and is introduced into the Congressional Record on 5145 by Helen Gehagan Douglas. It is no exaggeration to say that the seeds of the next war will be nourished or rooted up at San Francisco. Of course, this is upon the anniversary of the conference at which the United Nations was formed in late April and early May of 1945 in San Francisco. Again, a little over 50 years ago. Beginning again, it is no exaggeration to say that the seeds of the next war will be nourished or rooted up at San Francisco. Actually, the seeds have already been planted, but the roots are not deep, and they can be torn up. Interjecting, of course, they were not torn up. They grew to fruition. Continuing. Already certain groups, already certain groups inside the State Department and the British Foreign Office have been jockeying to build up Germany after the war as a bulwark against Russia. Already United States admirals have focused the attention of the entire world on the island bases we are taking from Japan so that Russia is becoming suspicious they will be aimed against her. Already there is evidence that the brass hats in at least two countries, plus certain diplomats, are getting nervous trigger fingers. Finally, Admiral Ernest King, commander of the fleet, took things into his own hands and made a public statement against the president's, FDR's, policy regarding Pacific Islands. In other words, he went over the head of his commander-in-chief. The Russians, whose intelligence is the best in the world, already knew that Admiral King is the man who wanted to build up a big navy now as protection against Russia later. They also knew that Admiral King has opposed Russia coming into the war against Japan and wants the U.S. to do the job alone. Eisenhower and Marshall do not side with King. In numerous archive shows, including the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America program number 10, the seminal archive show Uncle Sam and the Swastika, among other broadcasts, we have dealt with the pro-fascist and pro-Nazi sentiment of many of the most powerful industrialist financiers and political and national security figures in this country, and their desire to not only use Germany and the pre-World War II period as a bulwark against, quote, communism, unquote, but their recapitulation of that same stratagem and their eventual successful realization of that same stratagem during the Cold War. Again, although certainly there are many, many fine people in Germany of sincerely democratic and anti-Nazi sentiment, the institutions in Germany were never effectively denazified. The industrialist financiers, political figures, military and intelligence figures, civil service, judges, prosecutors, and laws from Nazi Germany were basically simply put right back into effect. I've dealt with that in Radio Free America number 2, Radio Free America number 37, and in a very important 13-part miscellaneous archive series entitled Reunited Germany, the New Danger, which many listeners have already heard. The seeds of what Drew Pearson referred to as the next war, obviously that next war was the Cold War, were indeed being laid in San Francisco, or were being planted in San Francisco, and we're going to take up next the column that Drew Pearson wrote the very next day from the column that we just heard, that namely April, the column that we're about to read is from April 26th of 1945. Remember that these columns were suppressed by his editors at the suggestion of the Morgan and Chase Banks, who, as we have seen in the past and will see in the future, were ardently and wholeheartedly pro-fascist and did business with the fascist powers of Europe even after America's entry into the war. The next column reads, San Francisco, April 26th. For a long time, it has been no secret that a group inside the State Department favored a soft peace for Germany with a view to making her a bulwark against Russia after the war. But as long as Roosevelt was in the White House, the State Department appeasers kept quiet. However, on the day after his body was buried, a meeting of the German Reparations Committee was held in the office of Assistant Secretary Will Clayton, C-L-A-Y-T-O-N, at which both the State and War Department suddenly reversed Roosevelt's policy of a hard peace. Specifically, they argued against the removal of Nazi factories, machine tools, plant equipment, or goods out of Germany. The Russians had proposed the removal of German war plants to build up the hundreds of Russian factories destroyed by Germany. Clayton argued that American policy should favor leaving factory equipment and machinery in Germany so she can get back on a sound economic basis. He even mentioned the fact that Germany would need to import cotton to manufacture clothes. Clayton is the biggest cotton exporter in the world and did a heavy business with the Nazis before the war. Unfortunately, the Russians are all too familiar with the attitude of the state and war departments toward them. The Russians cannot forget, among other things, the strategy of the Clevedon set in England, that's C-L-I-V-E-D-E-N. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, by the way. I pronounce it Clevedon, maybe it's Clevedon, I don't know. I've never heard it spoken aloud. Anyway, the Clevedon set in England, with which Churchill was once sympathetic, to stir up war between Germany and Russia while England sat on the sidelines. The Russians also know all too well the type of anti-Russian conversation that goes on at the home of Mrs. Evelyn Walsh Hope Diamond McLean when she entertains the elite of Washington society at her famous dinners at what is sometimes called the headquarters of the American Clevedon set. The Russians knew in advance, for instance, that the Douglas Aircraft Company had sold the plans for its DC-4 to Japan for $1 million before Pearl Harbor. And they have been especially interested in the War Department's survey of the damage done to German war plants by U.S. planes, a survey to be undertaken by a group of bankers and top insurance executives, including Henry C. Alexander, vice president of J.P. Morgan, Fred Searles, Jr., president of several J.P. Morgan mine companies, Franklin Dollier, D'Oleier, president of the Prudential Life Insurance Company, one of the corporation heads who founded and subsidized the American Legion in 1919, and Robert P. Russell, president of Standard Oil Development Company. Interrupting, we have taken a look at the profound role of American industrialists and financiers in not only supporting the Third Reich industrially and financially, but politically as well, and the profound role of those same industrial and financial interests in seeing to it that their counterparts and business partners in Germany and Italy with whom they had done business were not, in fact, rooted out, denazified, or tried. Also note, by the way, that these columns were suppressed at the instigation of the Chase and Morgan banks, who did business with the fascist powers of Europe. They were introduced into the congressional record by Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was defeated by Richard Nixon, an individual whose entire political career is inseparable from the forces of international fascism. Another of his early political conquests was Jerry Voorhees, who, as we saw in Radio Free America number 2, led the fight on the floor of Congress to break up the IG Farben Nazi chemical cartel. I would also note that in a segment that listeners will be hearing later this evening or in subsequent weeks, the role of Richard Nixon in an Allen Dulles and U.S. intelligence project to settle Nazi war criminals and a Third Reich and Eastern European fascist collaborators in the United States in areas that had large numbers of Jewish voters to counteract the perceived effect of those Jewish voters. This project was an Allen Dulles project. It was headed up by Richard Nixon. One of the spokespersons for one of the related projects was Ronald Reagan. This was done in conjunction with the Crusade for Freedom and the Office of Policy Coordination. We dealt with that in Radio Free America number 37. Ronald Reagan was the spokesperson for this project. William Casey actually handled many of the machinations by which the State Department ushered these people into the United States. This, however, was Richard Nixon's baby, and as we saw in Radio Free America number 2, Richard Nixon was instrumental in bringing Nicolae Malaxa, a business partner of Hermann Göring and the financier of the Romanian fascist Iron Guard, into the United States. His Whittier Law Office was used as a front company, which served as the justification for keeping Malaxa in the United States and successfully resisting deportation efforts. Later, Nixon invited Valerian Trifa, Viorel Trifa, the leader of the Green Shirts, and another Romanian Iron Guardist who led a brutal pogrom in Bucharest in which hundreds of Jews were killed. A number of them were slaughtered in the municipal slaughterhouse and then hung on meat hooks with the sign Kosher Meat. He later became the Archbishop of the American Romanian Orthodox Episcopate and was invited by Richard Nixon to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. It is interesting that Richard Nixon has acquired the totally inappropriate political legend as an elder statesman and a Democrat. There was almost nothing he did that was Democratic, from his role with the Odessa and bringing Nazi war criminals into the United States to his role in the assassination of President Kennedy, his probable role in the assassination of Robert Kennedy and the shooting of George Wallace, his attempts to stage a provocation of the 1972 Republican Convention to force the cancellation of the 72 elections and the instigation of martial law, his massive, virtually lifelong complicity with organized crime and the drug trade, his seminal role in setting up the many of the heroin refiners in the Southeast Asian drug traffic, and also his role with the Miami and Latin American fascist milieu grouped around the Bay of Pigs situation. merely some of the many highlights or lowlights of Richard Nixon's, quote, role as a Democrat, unquote, with a small d. Totally false political mythology, but one that a lot of people subscribe to. We should note that Richard Nixon's political genesis took place at this time and in conjunction with the forces that we're looking at here. Continuing with the Drew Pearson column from 426-45. Considering the manner in which Standard Oil of New Jersey collaborated with Hitler's cartels even after the war broke in Europe, and considering how the J.P. Morgan branch bank in Paris collaborated with the Nazis even after Pearl Harbor, you can't blame the Russians for wondering whether this survey actually isn't for the purpose of getting a line on German industry and building it up after the war. As we saw in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Radio Free America programs 1 and 2, that is exactly what happened. And indeed, these same industrialists and financiers, many of them doubling as intelligence operatives, were instrumental in seeing to it that that's the way things worked. By the way, a current book, The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, hardcover St. Martin's, 1994, is an excellent source for getting a handle on much of this information. Beginning that last paragraph again. Considering the manner in which Standard Oil of New Jersey collaborated with Hitler's cartels even after the war broke in Europe, and considering how the J.P. Morgan branch bank in Paris collaborated with the Nazis even after Pearl Harbor, you can't blame the Russians for wondering whether this survey actually isn't for the purpose of getting a line on German industry and building it up after the war. Already, the State Department is being bombarded by American industrialists who owned factories in Germany before the war and want to go back and start operating them. Among the leading pressure boys is Graham Howard, vice president of General Motors, in charge of operations in Europe and Germany. By the way, we talked about him in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Note also that many American corporations, as we saw in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, were compensated for plants that were bombed by the Allies in World War II. Continuing. Howard helped organize Franco's of Graham Howard, whom we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Howard helped organize Franco's truck transport service during the Spanish Civil War, has a personal interest in the Opel Auto Works in Germany, and has been busy as a hound dog around the State Department wanting to get back to Germany. Quote, naturally, they can't have a hard peace if they are to build up Germany, so they don't want German factories and machine tools carted off to Russia. Another factor making the Russians suspicious is the British demand that food which the Russian army finds in Germany be used to feed the German people rather than to feed the starving Poles and Russian slave laborers. Shortly before he left London, both Foreign Minister Eden and Sir James Grigg, British War Minister, took the position in secret talks with the United States officials that food found in Germany must be used to feed the German, not Polish and Russian civilians. The British argument is that if German food is diverted to the Poles and Russians, the Allies will have to import more to feed the Germans. Finally, the Russians are probably most suspicious of the mysterious U.S. espionage organization called OSS. The OSS, or Office of Strategic Services, has, strangely, distributed some of the most powerful bankers' representatives in the United States of America at key points where they can influence U.S. policy in occupied Germany. The roster of OSS men who have been or are operating in Europe reads like a blue stocking list of the first 60 families. It includes Paul Mellon, son of Andrew Mellon, Junius and Henry Morgan of the House of Morgan, Alfred DuPont, Lester Armour of the Chicago Armours, Gordon Auchincloss and John Auchincloss, by the way, blood relatives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, continuing Warwick Potter, Harold Coolidge, William Van Allen of the Astor family, and Alan Dulles, attorney for various international bankers with previous connections in Germany. Note, the Dulles Law Firm, of which John Foster Dulles, one of the main consultants of the reactionary or Vandenberg wing of the U.S. delegation at San Francisco, is the head, is the attorney of its American Schroeder Bank affiliated with the British Schroeders, which had business connections with the Nazi Schroeders. All are relatives. By the way, we dealt with the Dulles Schroeder Third Reich connection in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, a very, very good book talking about the relationship between the OSS and the Wall Street elite, The Old Boys, The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H. That book is out of print, but it's well worthwhile. Continuing with this Drew Pearson column from 426-45, again suppressed at the time. Some of these may not deserve the suspicion focused upon them, but others more than make up for it. And anyone listening for 30 minutes to their conversation about the next war and building up Germany as a partner in that war can understand why the Russians wrongly accuse us of a deal to permit the American army to enter Berlin first. This is the kind of underlying suspicion which must be killed immediately and permanently if the machinery of San Francisco is to bring about permanent peace. As we shall see, these suspicions were to a large extent well-founded, or as we have seen, I should say. Continuing. San Francisco, April 27th. This is the next Drew Pearson column. When the American army swept into Germany, it was fortunate enough to capture an interesting figure in Dr. H. J. Caesar, C-A-E-S-A-R, the counterpart of our alien property custodian, who had charge of all American banks and alien property seized in France. Dr. Caesar was cross-examined at length. From him came highly enlightening and hitherto secret information about the manner in which certain British and American branch banks in Paris collaborated with the Germans after the fall of France. His testimony highlights the main issue underlying the problem of future peace, namely, whether, despite all the plans worked out at San Francisco, certain Allied business firms, together with their friends in the State Department, the Army, and the British Foreign Office, are going to maneuver behind the scenes to strengthen Germany once again as a bulwark against Russia. This largely lies at the root of the ticklish Polish question. Russia wants a Poland which will cooperate with her and be a buffer against another German invasion. Before Poland was invaded last time, it will be remembered that British business interests were quite willing, even apparently anxious, to have the Sudetenland taken away from Czechoslovakia. Finally, it was American and British banks which poured money into Germany for years before the war and then maneuvered to have reparations and war debts canceled in order to protect their own loans. The Chase National Bank was one of the worst offenders. That is why a lot of people in Washington, Moscow, and the world at large are watching to see whether history will repeat. That is why the evidence unearthed from the secret files of German alien property custodian Caesar is so significant. It indicates that even during the present war, the Paris branches of Chase and J.P. Morgan were quite willing and anxious to do business with the Germans, though British banks were more so. Dr. Caesar testified that, quote, the protection afforded to Chase was justified on the grounds that it had been active on behalf of Germany before the war in such matters as the German standstill credit negotiations. The British banks, he said, were even more preferred by the Germans than the branches of Chase and Morgan's. The German occupying authorities decreed that the British and Canadian banks in the occupied zone of France, quote, shall no longer be considered as enemy banks, unquote. These branches provided long-term credits to assist the German war machine. But especially significant were some of the letters found in Dr. Caesar's files. One indicated that the J.P. Morgan and Company had gone out of its way to curry favor with the Nazis by showing that the Morgans had nothing to do with Jews. One memo sent to American banking czar Caesar by Mr. Decestre, L-E-C-E-S-T-R-E, a high official of the Morgan firm, read, on the attached sheet, there is represented some information relative to the predecessors of Mr. J.P. Morgan, actual head of J.P. Morgan and Company Incorporated, New York. Following the tradition of his father, Mr. Morgan never admitted Jews as associates or fellow workers. The Morgan House has been frequently found in its business in opposition to the great Jewish banking houses in the United States, such as Kuhn, Loeb & Company. As to Morgan & C. Paris, the personnel since the foundation of the bank in 1868 has never included a Jew. This memo is dated January 15, 1943, more than a year after Germany declared war on the United States. Listeners wishing to learn more about some of the archive shows, such as the Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 10, and Uncle Sam and the Swastika, are referred to the aforementioned Archives on Audio, a tape duplication service. They can be contacted at area code 415-346-1840. That's 415-346-1840, P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. There's a 20-page catalog available. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.